So in September of 2023, I saw this really cool article about this really cool experiment where they measured the gravitational effects on the motion of antimatter atoms. And I thought, oh my God, they did it. That's amazing. How did they do that? And then I was like, what a thing to make a content about. But then I got distracted by like bad science news. And then I was like, well, if I'm gonna make a video about an antimatter experiment, I should talk briefly about antimatter. So if you need to know about antimatter, watch this one first. But briefly, antimatter and antimatter hydrogen, which is what we're gonna be looking at, is made up of an antiproton, which is the same mass as a proton inside of a regular hydrogen, but it has the opposite charge, and it's surrounded by an anti-electron, sometimes called a positron, that is the same mass as a regular electron, but it has a positive charge. So this is what a regular old hydrogen looks like, and this is what an anti-hydrogen looks like. And the thing about antimatter and matter is that when you make particles, they are made in pairs like that, right? So you'll make an electron, but you'll also make a positron every single time. But when we look around the universe, the big question is like, okay, but everything's made of matter. Like this meat sack sitting in front of the camera, made of matter. The antimatter's not around. So, open question. So, that's one of the reasons we want to study antimatter, so we can try to explain like what happened early in the universe that led to where we are now, where it seems like matter has won and it is just dominated over the antimatter. Where did that go? We have to study the antimatter to answer that question. One of the ways we do that is by learning about its basic properties, like how it interacts with gravity. So we're back around. So you might have seen this paper and said, why would they measure that? Of course, antimatter falls down. What a silly thing to measure. Of course, gravity works the same for matter and antimatter. Of course it does. Why would you spend, presumably, conservatively, hundreds of millions of dollars at CERN measuring the fact that antimatter falls down? Of course it falls down. And I would like to answer that question of why would you do this with three very specific reasons from three different experiments. It's a framing of a video. So the first reason why you would do this, why would you measure antimatter falling down? Of course it falls down, is because like you kind of just have to check, right? What if it didn't? You have to check. That's my favorite kind of experiment. Like, is this gonna happen the way we expect it? Yep, it did. So the year is 1957. They're doing a conference, with physicists about particle physics and all the stuff, like your post-World War II style of physics. And Bill Fairbanks, American physicist, was there, and I think he was just a student at the time. And in the session on antimatter, the session chair, Bryce DeWitt, says this: nothing is known about the gravitational acceleration of antimatter. So this was just a statement of fact. At the time, in 1957, no one had measured how the very newly discovered antimatter interacted with gravity. And this just kind of wiggled its way into Bill Fairbanks' head. And he just kind of sat on that. And then years later, in 1968, he's a professor at Stanford. And his student Whitburn and him decide, let's test this. So they develop an experiment to measure how gravity affects the motion of electrons, with the ultimate goal of then testing positrons and comparing the results. Do you get the same value for gravitational acceleration for an electron and a positron? You should, if it only depends on mass, which we expect it to based on what we know about gravity. So they develop this free fall apparatus where they kind of shoot electrons up and they want them to fall down. And they can put some like fields on it to try and supplement gravity in one way or the other, because of course, electrons have charge. They will be strongly affected by any fields much, much more than they would gravity. So the idea is like, oh, we could do an artificial gravity type situation by putting an electric field around this and maybe comparing it with different values of the field, and maybe that would be a good proxy for measuring gravity, because gravity is orders and orders and orders and orders of magnitude weaker than the electromagnetic force. So if you're going to measure something like how a charged particle interacts with gravity, you need to have complete accurate knowledge of every single electromagnetic field that particle is also experiencing. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to pull the gravity out because the gravity is just so much, much more weaker. And it turns out that this experiment is just impossible. Like, you can't do it, especially in 1958. Like, yeah, you can make a beam of electrons. You can try to remove as many electromagnetic fields as you can, but environmental effects will just overwhelm the numbers, and you cannot pull out gravity's contribution to that motion because that contribution is so tiny. So the goal of measuring the gravitational effect on electrons and then comparing it to positrons never happened because they just couldn't do the experiment. Of course, they got results, but they weren't confident that they had actually measured the value. So they published this Nature paper in 1968, and they're like, great idea, we just can't do it yet. And Bill Fairbanks kind of continues this work. He goes on talking about like why it's important to study the gravitational effects on antimatter particles. Like, what could that tell us? And of course, we don't know anything about it until we can measure it. And that's why we do the physics, right? To learn things. That's my favorite reason to do anything. Like, are you sure it's going to happen the way you think it's going to happen? The second reason, which will lead to our second experiment on like why you want to study what happens when antimatter interacts with gravity, of course it falls down, of course it does, is because we don't really understand gravity. I would put an asterisk on that. We have this wonderful theory of gravity called general relativity, and it makes all these predictions, and it's always right, and we love to see it. However, on the smallest scales, like the Planck scale, we expect that our wonderful theory of gravity does not, well, I guess we don't expect it. We know that our wonderful theory of gravity, general relativity, will not match the results from our other wonderful theory, like standard model physics, standard model cosmology. Like, you have your quantum mechanics and your QCD and all of this stuff that works really, really well. They just don't match on the Planck scale. And people don't like this. It's very upsetting for some people. And so they develop ideas like quantum gravity, which is just string theory. In order to understand gravity, we need to do experiments with it. We need to test what we think will happen in order to ensure that that's what will happen, or maybe something will be different. Maybe we will do a test on gravity one day and we get the unexpected answer, and then that will be a clue on how we can solve this big problem. So one of the things they test is the weak equivalence principle, which is a requirement of general relativity, which says that inertial mass and gravitational mass are the same mass. There's just one type of mass and they have to be the same, which means that everybody will experience gravity the same way. Been known since Galileo, if things are in free fall and they are dropped at the same time, they will fall at the same rate and they will land at the same time. Their inertial mass is identical to their gravitational mass, but we have to test it. So we can test the weak equivalence principle by ensuring that antimatter, such as an antiproton, will fall in exactly the same way that a proton would. And any difference in that measurement is a clue on how we can fix gravity at the Planck scale. We really have a handle on it in every other context, guys. I'm a general relativity stan. Deal with it. We don't need quantum gravity. Get out of here with that. So push forward in time to the 1990s. We're getting a lot better at making antimatter, and the dream of having an antiproton beam is right there for us to grab. And we're like, okay, what if we take Fairbanks's idea of, you know, just dropping electrons, and instead we drop protons and antiprotons, because those boys are 2,000 times more massive than electrons and positrons. The more mass you have, the easier it should be to measure the gravitational effect, right? 2,000 times larger this is it. We're going to do it. So I'm going to read to you from a little conference proceedings that I found from 1990, and it's about an antimatter gravity project that was going to take place at the Lear facility, which is at CERN. And they cite heavily Fairbanks' idea. What they plan to do is build a device that will shoot antiprotons up. They can put a thin film of some material they don't describe, which the antiprotons will shoot through and will slow them down. And they will slow down, they will rise up, and then hopefully you can observe them falling back down. The trouble is finding a gravity-dominant space from which to launch. Like, oh, it's been 20 years, man. Yeah, that's the problem. There's electromagnetic fields everywhere. Where is your gravity-dominant field? What are you doing there? How are you solving that problem? That's so, it's the same thing. Because the thing is, this is impossible. You can't do this with a charged particle. There's just too many fields, man. Gravity is so weak. You can't do it. You can't do it with a charged particle. But they're very confident. They're super confident in this conference proceedings. And they frame this experiment, which there's this whole thing with like funding and like prestige and how you present your results. Like, they're doing the exact same experiment that Fairbanks is doing. Fairbanks was framing it as like, this is important to test. Isn't it interesting? No one knows what antimatter does with gravity. They're framing it as, we don't understand gravity. This will be the first ever test of the weak equivalence principle. They're gonna do it. They're gonna get an antiproton beam. The antiproton is 2,000 more times massive. They've solved the problem. I feel like I've already hinted that. Of course, this does not happen. But I love how they end the paper. After measuring G for protons and negative hydrogen ions at Los Alamos, the experiment will be moved to Lear in order to measure the gravitational acceleration of antiprotons and thereby perform the first test ever of the weak equivalent principle for antimatter. No, they didn't. They didn't. This didn't happen. This, like, lost funding and it just never happened. They probably realized that you can't do it with charged particles, and they started working on the one that actually worked, which is the one I'm going to talk about next. I do think it's interesting how the framing of this problem has changed. Because in the 80s and 90s, it was all like, gravity, we don't understand gravity, gravity, what's going on with gravity? In this experiment, which is called Alpha G, I feel like they start talking a lot more about, we need to understand antimatter. Because of course, there's the whole baryogenesis problem. Like, we know that when you make an antiproton, you have to make a proton. So where are all the antiprotons? This is a huge open question for cosmology and like what we know about how the universe works. And yeah, they talk about the weak equivalence principle, but it seems much more focused on, we need to learn the properties of antimatter in order to understand antimatter. Because what if antimatter falls down, but it's like a little bit different? Like, gravity affects antimatter in just like a slightly different way, or maybe just being present in a matter space, antimatter behaves differently. And what can we learn about antimatter? That's the framing of this. This is the third experiment, the big one. Why would anybody measure the gravitational effect on antimatter? Because we don't know anything about antimatter, and it's important. Because we don't know what happened to all the antimatter. Where did it go? And I would love to walk you through this experiment because it's so stinking cool. Okay, so I'm just gonna be reading from the Nature paper. I will link it below, of course. So the idea is not much different from Fairbanks' original idea. However, instead of using a charged antimatter particle, they're using an anti-hydrogen. So the charge should be zero, should nearly zero. You can still trap it with magnetic fields because of like quantum mechanical spin, but it's fine. Electromagnetic fields won't play as big a role in this because it's an atom, it's not an ion. Great, that's how you gotta do it. That's how it has to be done. So they have this vertical trap, they pile up their anti-hydrogen. They have like a anti-proton beam and it shoots like a bunch of anti-protons in like a plasma. And then they shoot in your anti-electrons also in a plasma. And then from that you get a couple hundred antihydrogen and you can store them. And so you have this little canister of antihydrogen and they release the top and bottom walls of the magnetic trap and they observe what happens. And what should happen is that most of those antihydrogen should fall down. Like, they're in a canister, you remove the floor, it should fall down. Of course, because this is like a plasma and those things are interacting with each other, you would expect some of them to have a velocity that would allow them to go up. But most of them, if antimatter interacts with gravity the way we expect it to, of course it falls down. Most of them will fall down. What happens when these guys escape is that they just hit the walls of the apparatus and they immediately annihilate, which sends a signal to their detector. And I mentioned this in my other antimatter video, but I still think it's hilarious that as a child I was terrified of people making antimatter because, oh my gosh, it annihilates and it's going to destroy everything in its path, when they literally just let it annihilate in the cage and it does nothing to the device. It's totally fine. It's so little energy. You'll never have an antimatter engine. There's so little energy there. You have to make so much. It takes them all that time to make like 200. Anyway, so they drop the walls. Some of them go up. Some of them go down. Where they hit the detector and annihilate allows them to determine if that antihydrogen went up or if it went down, and they can just start doing statistics on how many did what. It's really interesting to me that they have to cycle through to get a big enough pile of antihydrogen. Like, they're making like 10 to the 6 antiprotons, and they're shooting in a similar amount of antielectrons, and through each little collision of those two plasmas, they get a few antihydrogen. So those antihydrogen hang out in the trap and then they kind of run again and they pile them up. They call it stacking until they get a couple hundred, which is such a teeny tiny amount of antihydrogen. This device is so small. I think they have the numbers. 4.4 centimeters in diameter, 25.6 centimeters in height. That's a little teeny tiny boy where they have 100 or so antihydrogen. I like this line too. They say, we typically accumulated antiatoms for 50 stacks in roughly 4 hours, resulting in about 100 atoms trapped. So if you compare 100 atoms to Avogadro's number, it's like 0 atoms. So like, we're never gonna have an antimatter engine, guys, but it's still really, really cool. They've run numerical simulations where they expect that if they did this same experiment for hydrogen, regular standard hydrogen, which we know how it interacts with gravity, 20% of them would go up and 80% would fall down. So if antihydrogen behaves the same way as we expect it to, we should see those same numbers. 20% should escape to the top. Most of them, 80%, should fall down. And they do this really cool trick where, in addition to just running like standard gravity, they can put in magnetic fields that will apply an upward or a downward force on the antihydrogen. So they're like, okay, if in a normal situation, 1G is pointing down, we can make a magnetic field that will apply a force that will push these particles up by 1G. In that case, you would expect half to go up and half to go down. And then they're like, okay, well, gravity is 1G pushing down. What if we put 10G pushing up? We like artificially do that with a magnetic field. Then you would expect all of them to go up, right? And they can do the same thing by applying a downward force and being like, okay, now these antihydrogen are experiencing 5 Gs of force. All of them must come down. And they can do that to kind of calibrate their machine, but also get really good number statistics on what's happening. And they have this beautiful little plot where they've done exactly that. So they have escape histograms where down is to the left and up is to the right. And they've increased in values of G, where like 1G is what we experience with gravity. And at 1G, they see just what they expected, like 80% fall down. You can see as they increase gravity by adding in that field to apply a force, more and more of the particles start coming out of the down end, just like you would expect. And when they increase it the other way, more and more of the particles start going out of the up end, just as you would expect. You're starting to think like, hey, antihydrogen does interact with gravity just like we expect it would. Isn't that really cool? Each of these runs with the different levels of gravity were done with like 300, and the paper goes into a lot of detail on how they determined what was what and their methods and their statistics, and it's a really easy read. I recommend it. I'm not going to go through all of it right now. So here's that same histogram, but as a table, and you can see what's happening, right? Like, as they're changing the direction of gravity, the numbers that go up and down change with it, exactly as you would expect. What a nice little result. Of course, antimatter falls down. And then the big plot of the paper is figure 5, where they're comparing their experimental data to what would happen if the anti-atoms didn't experience gravity, which is the middle line, to what would happen if they experienced gravity, just like regular atoms do, and then if they experienced anti-gravity. And you can see that the data fits really nicely with they experience gravity. Let me read it to you. Qualitatively, the experimental data in figure 5 exhibit the behavior characteristic of gravitational attraction between antihydrogen and the Earth. At a bias of about plus 3g or minus 3g, the antiatoms exit predominantly at the bottom or the top of the trap, as the magnetic imbalance is significantly larger than g. The fraction exiting through the bottom increases monotonically as the bias increases from minus 3g to 3g. The balance point is close to minus 1g, as naively expected from the simplified one-dimensional argument presented above. They did it! Yay, go CERN! So now let me read you their conclusions. We have searched for evidence of the effect of gravity on the motion of particles of neutral antimatter. The best fit of our measurement yields a value of 0.75 plus or minus 0.13, which is statistical and systematic errors, plus or minus 0.16, which is simulation errors of G. So I just want to make a little comparison for what we know about hydrogen and then what we know about the anti-hydrogen now. And these numbers, even though the error bars on one is a lot bigger, are the same number. So antimatter falls down. Of course it does. But now there's statistics. And they go into a lot of detail on reducing these error bars. They talk about getting slower antihydrogen, which will make it easier to measure, which will also lower errors. They talk about changing the dimensions of the trap, all of this stuff to really nail down these error bars and get a better number. But this is a really exciting, like, first pass results. The conclusion also says, consequently, we can rule out the existence of repulsive gravity of magnitude 1g between the Earth and antimatter. The results are thus far in conformity with the predictions of general relativity. Hell yeah! General relativity, you've never been wrong, man. Keep getting it. Our results do not support cosmological models relying on repulsive matter, antimatter gravitation. So there is a cosmological model that suggests that if antimatter follows anti-gravity, like repulsive gravity instead of gravity, it could explain all of the dark energy and all of the dark matter. And it's kind of a fringe theory, but they say they've ruled that out. I think that's what they're referring to here. They also talk about how in the future, when they do try to like lower the statistical error in order to get a much stronger number, they are going to do it so that they have a stringent test of the weak equivalence principle. So it's kind of also back to gravity. But I just love this experiment. I love the simple, I mean, I know this isn't simple, but it's such a simple idea. This is essentially the same experiment that Fairbank wanted to do in 1968. He just didn't have the antimatter. It's hard to make. It's hard to get to a neutral antimatter. And here we are, in 2023, and they did it. They did it. Of course antimatter falls down. Of course it does. Listen, CERN, I know that you're some of the best experimental physicists in the world, and I'm just a theorist, and this is not even my field of expertise, but if I had one critique, I wish you would have done this experiment with hydrogen. Like, just to compare. Like, you've done it with anti-hydrogen, and you're comparing it to simulations, but you have the device. Like, surely CERN has a beam of protons and a beam of electrons, and they could just do the exact same experiment. And we get a nice little, like, see, it's the same. See, they, of course they fall at the same time. That would be cool. I love how they end this paper. Formerly the subject of countless thought experiments and indirect inferences, the motion of antimatter in the gravitational field of the Earth finally has a sound and promising experimental foothold. Nice. What a nice experiment. I love this paper. I love this result. General relativity wins again. We did it, boys. So let's talk about why antimatter and anti-gravity are always talked about at the same time, because I don't really understand that either. Like, here's the thing. You have the standard model of particles, like your protons, your neutrons, all that good stuff. And as I talked about in that other video, in 1928, Dirac has this theoretical result where he's like, you guys, there could be antimatter. And then 4 years later, it's like, oh, here's the antimatter. So you have the standard model of particles, and then you have the antimatter particles with a little bar, right? Great. When people think about anti-gravity, which they mean, like, instead of attractive forces, they have repulsive forces. I don't understand why they expect antimatter to be the one that follows anti-gravity. I mean, what indication do we have that it would be? Of course, because gravity is not in the standard model, but whatever. But I always imagined it when I heard about anti-gravity, like before I studied physics and realized that, of course, there's no anti-gravity, whatever. I always imagined it as like, okay, you have your standard model particles, you have your antimatter particles, you have your standard model particles that are anti-gravity. So like, imagine you have a proton, you have an antiproton, you have an anti-gravity proton, like you could have a little dot on top or something. No, the dots take it. Do like a little triangle on top for anti-gravity. Like this time the gravity goes up, you know, so it's a triangle pointing up. And then you would have an antiproton with a bar, but also a triangle, because like I imagined, like if you have a graviton or if you have some sort of gravity charge, proton and antiproton have a plus one because they interact with gravity the normal way. And then these guys would have a minus one. Why did people always put antimatter in the anti-gravity pile? I read all these papers. All I saw was these really hideous, annoying debates about, like, you think you've proved anti-gravity isn't real, but all you've proven is that an anti-apple will fall to an anti-earth, and it was lame and boring. So I don't know. But let me tell you about the first man to disprove anti-gravity, and, like, we can just let him have it. We have to do this all the time. It's Maxwell. Have you ever read Maxwell's A Dynamical Theory of the Electromagnetic Force paper? It's very long, but I feel like I've mentioned that people should read it before. There's a little section on gravity, which again, I'm just going to read aloud to you. I'm so sorry. After tracing the action of the surrounding medium, both the magnetic and the electric attractions and repulsions, and finding them to depend on the inverse square of the distance, we are naturally led to inquire whether the attraction of gravitation, which follows the same law of distance, is not also traceable to the action of the surrounding medium. Gravitation differs from magnetism and electricity in this, that the bodies concerned are all of the same kind, instead of being opposite signs like magnetic poles and electrified bodies, and that the force between these bodies is an attraction and not a repulsion, as in the case between the electric and magnetic bodies. So he's just saying that gravity looks a lot like the electromagnetic force, but we don't have negative gravity. We don't have that. Why is that? The lines of gravitating force near two dense bodies are exactly of the same form as the lines of magnetic force near two poles of the same name. But whereas the poles are repelled, the bodies are attracted. I'm not going to read the math. I hate reading math. That if R is the resultant gravitating force and R prime is the resulting magnetic force at corresponding parts of the field, the intrinsic energy of the field of gravitation must therefore be less wherever there is a resulting gravitational force. What this means, and remember, this is before general relativity. This is Maxwell. No one gives Maxwell enough credit. Oh my God. I mean, if you haven't read this before, like, sit down. I'm going to read it to you now. As energy is essentially positive, it is impossible for any part of space to have negative intrinsic energy. Hence, those parts of space in which there is no resultant force, such as the points of equilibrium in the space between the different bodies of a system and within the substance of each body, must have an intrinsic energy per unit volume greater than, where R is the greatest possible value of intensity of gravitating force in any part of the universe. Oh my God. This is before Einstein, guys. This is before general relativity. Okay. The assumption, therefore, that gravitation arises from the action of surrounding medium in the way pointed out leads to the conclusion that every part of the medium possesses, when undisturbed, an enormous intrinsic energy, and that the presence of dense bodies influences the medium so as to diminish this energy wherever there is a resultant attraction. Guys, he said that gravity is trapped in space. this, he said it. I've said this in a video before, but Maxwell died when he was 48, which is so young. And this is what he was doing just before. He would have done it. He was so close, but listen to the last sentence. As I am unable to understand in what way a medium can possess such properties, I cannot go any further in this direction in searching for the cause of gravitation. What a way to end that. Just like, here, let me just point out how general relativity works, and then like, I don't know. What do you think, guys? What do you think Einstein could think? Einstein standing on the shoulders of Maxwell. And then he just goes on to like, okay, now here's my theory about condensers. Brilliant. So Maxwell says that you can't have repulsive gravity. That doesn't make sense because of energy conservation. And people have been debating this for years and years and years. And there's some version of quantum gravity where like, actually it doesn't break CPTs. Well, like it's fine, strings and okay. But the reason people keep thinking about anti-gravity and antimatter at the same time, I do think is because of Dirac. Dirac did that thing where he was like, guys, antimatter isn't excluded. We can have a proton with a negative charge. It's right there in the math. And then someone found those things, right? So if you do a similar thing that I talked about in this video with general relativity, you can come to the conclusion that's like, general relativity doesn't say you can't have repulsive gravity. It could be there. It could be. Maybe it's the antimatter. It's the same thing, kind of, right? The difference, the huge difference, is that Dirac suggested, hey, maybe antiparticles, it's not allowed. And then we found the antiparticles. Like, maybe we could have repulsive gravity. Maybe it's fine. But the thing is, we haven't done the second part. Like, yeah, it's allowed in the math, but you need an experimental verification. You need to find the anti-gravity. You need to observe it. You need to touch it and poke it with a stick. And we haven't done that. So there's no anti-gravity. It's just a little thought experiment that has not yet fruited anything. So why do people keep talking about it? Well, here's my idea. Here's my theory. Here's my tinfoil hat. So in the 50s, 60s, 70s, like you have this fabulous time where you're like, oh, the weak force, oh, the electro weak force, oh my gosh, renormalization, oh my gosh, you can't renormalize gravity, it's a problem, what about anti-gravity? And then like sci-fi authors started putting like anti-gravity devices, like, oh, what if you had an anti-gravity engine? And it's in Star Trek and Star Wars and stuff. And that kind of got seeded in people's brains as like a thing that was possible, even like, no, it doesn't even make sense. And then you have like crackpot theories about anti-gravity, and there's a whole bunch of conspiracy theories about like, don't you know this physicist in 1954 discovered anti-gravity and she got secreted away by the government, and there's like another guy from a different country and the same thing happened. And it's just like, if it was so easy to find anti-gravity, people would do it all the time. Michio Kaku would have done it in his garage when he was a teenager. Like, no, it doesn't make any sense. What would that even look like? Like, if everything was repulsed by other masses, then everything would just be isotropically spread apart. It doesn't make sense. You would never find... It's fine. Because the thing is that... of course antimatter falls down. Everyone expected it to fall down. Ask any physicist. So why? Why, when I'm so excited to learn about this result and I go to like the news, are, I want to say a generous 50% are like, they did it, antimatter falls down. And the other 50% are like, scientists baffled, scientists schooled again. And it's just like, no, we knew it was gonna fall down. Of course it falls down. My favorite, and I mean least favorite, is this one from some website called Futurism, where they say, scientists disappointed to find that antimatter falls when you drop it. They're disappointed. What? They just did an amazing thing. They just did an amazing thing that was like a little seed of an idea in someone's brain in 1957, and then they started doing the experiment in 1968, and now it is 2023, and they did the thing, and it's amazing. And you think they're disappointed? Who wrote that headline? What the fuck? If you actually read this article, there are lots of quotes. Like he says, the bummer news didn't exactly come as a surprise. Then there's a quote from a physicist at Berkeley, and he says, if you walk down the halls of this department and ask the physicists, they would all say this result is not the least bit surprising. Yeah, of course antimatter falls down. Why would they be disappointed? It doesn't make any sense. This article is just like, if antimatter didn't succumb to the effects of gravity, we could theoretically create a perpetual motion machine. Oh, yeah? Well, if friction didn't exist, we could also make a perpetual motion machine. If magic existed, we could make a perpetual... What are you talking about? What? You think the people who spent the last 30 years getting funding and setting up an experiment and running tests and training students are like, oh man, we can't make a perpetual motion machine now. All we did is this fundamental measurement. Oh man, I'm so disappointed. I hate it. I was trying to think of why someone would be disappointed with this. I'm not an experimentalist. I'm a theorist and I do simulations, and like the standard way you approach it is like, I am supposed to know the theory. I program the computer to do the thing I wanted to do. I should know what the answer will be, right? Like, I shouldn't expect the results. And if I don't know, I run a simulation and I open up the snapshot files and I'm looking at it and it looks totally different than what I expected. My brain doesn't go, oh yay, new physics. Ah, I trust what the computer says to me. No, my brain goes, oh man, I did something wrong because this is not what I expected at all. This is a problem, right? So I just imagine all the grad students who were working on this experiment and they get the data back and they're like, oh, thank God it does exactly what we thought, so we don't have to spend two more years trying to figure out all the things we messed up with the statistics or whatever. No one is disappointed with this result. This is amazing. It's kind of shitty. It's kind of shitty to take all this work and be like, aw, man, sorry, scientists, antimatter falls down. Of course it does. So, I saw this paper. So in this paper, they mention something I've never heard of, the microscope mission to test the equivalence principle, but in space. And I've never heard of that. And I thought that just was really cool. So I want to read you the abstract. The microscope mission was designed to test the weak equivalence principle, stating the equality between the inertial and gravitational masses. Its experimental test consisted of comparing the accelerations undergone by two collocated test masses of different compositions as they orbited Earth by measuring the electrostatic forces required to keep them in equilibrium. This was done with ultra-sensitive differential electrostatic accelerometers on board a drag-free satellite. Doesn't that sound amazing? Oh my God, experimental physicists are so cool. The mission lasted 2.5 years, accumulating 5 months worth of science freefall data, two-thirds with a pair of test masses of different compositions, titanium and platinum alloys, and the last third with a reference pair of test masses of the same composition, platinum. They summarize the results, and they find that the weak equivalence principle holds. General relativity did it again, boys. Bow, 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 bow.